From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Manipulating the Weather with Stephen Quayle. Well, another one in from Bin Laden. Al-Qaeda chief Osama Bin Laden called on Europeans to simply stop helping the Americans in the war in Afghanistan, saying America is ebbing. In excerpts of a new audio tape aired on Al Jazeera television, Bin Laden said that he was the only one responsible for the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, arguing that it was unjust for the Americans to have invaded Afghanistan. The message appeared to be a new attempt by Bin Laden to influence public opinion in the West. In 2004, he offered Europeans a truce if they simply stopped attacking Muslims, then later spoke of a truce with the United States. In both cases, Al-Qaeda later denounced the countries for not accepting its offer. In California, Rodney King, whose 1991 beating by Los Angeles police led to deadly rioting the next year, was shot on a street corner. But his wounds were not life-threatening. 42-year-old King was hit in the face, arms, back, and torso by birdshot fired from a shotgun. He was shot possibly two or three times from a distance. Now, this is for all of us who work late. Working the graveyard shift will soon be listed as a probable cause for cancer. I kid you not. It's a surprising step validating a concept once considered wacky, and it is based on research that finds higher rates of breast and prostate cancer among women and men whose work day starts after dark. Next month, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the cancer arm of the World Health Organization, will now add overnight work shifts as a probable carcinogen. Sad news out of Seattle. The voice of Larry Nelson, a longtime talk show host there, who retired in 1997, has been silenced. Larry Nelson, a great guy, dead at the age of 70, he lost his battle with lung cancer. In Jacksonville, Florida, a 14-year-old Florida student was facing third-degree battery charges after throwing a crayon at his teacher. He was kicked out of the school. His mother said the punishment was too harsh. He's a model student. A strong earthquake rocking Eastern Caribbean, sending office workers in Martinique all over the place. 7.4 magnitude earthquake there. A Russian woman gave birth by the light of dozens of mobile phones after a power cut plunged the town that she was in into darkness. Emergency generators eventually kicked on to help her, but everybody had to hold their mobile phones by her so they could give her enough light. By the way, if you get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the Digicam icon, which is listed there near the feature article. You'll see my little grandchild, Gavin, and 7 pounds, 6 ounces, but there he is if you want to take a look at him. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with an incredible story about an eyewitness who saw the military put a security ring around a low-hovering glowing disc in Albuquerque in 1974. Okay, here she is, Linda Moulton Howe, Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, and you know she goes right to the heart of the story to get some of the answers, and she's got another incredible one here for us. Hey, Linda, how are you?
Oh, George, hi, and happy holidays. This really is an amazing story, and what I'm going to share tonight goes back about 11 months ago with an email that I received in January 2007 from an Albuquerque resident named Paul McKeever. He said that he and his family had seen a glowing disc first in the sky and then on the ground surrounded by military, and he really had my attention. So I gave his phone number a call, and by March 4th of this year, I met with Paul at the apartment where his Aunt Sandy Rivers lived with her family in the early 1970s, and where Paul, at age 8, was visiting with his mother, Rebecca McKeever Armstrong, and he and his two cousins were playing outside when the three saw a bright, glowing white disc moving in the evening sky at the same time that their mothers heard radio station 770 KKOB announce a news alert that an unidentified flying object was in the air over Albuquerque. and the mother and aunt came running out. They got in a car. They chased down Albuquerque streets as they watched this glowing white disc move slowly and steadily downward in the sky toward the Sandia Hills. And what they saw has haunted them for the past 33 years. And what still puzzles them, and now me, is how could something so seemingly public to at least a few curious Albuquerque residents be so completely erased from media and public discussion afterward? And before we hear from the family tell their own story, I would like to let you and Coast listeners know that right now at my news website, www.earthfiles.com, there is a very big report about this glowing disc encounter with military in Albuquerque.
Okay.
It has maps, photos, drawings by the eyewitnesses, and documents. And there is even a 1974 Newsweek magazine article about all of the animal mutilations and mysterious discs that were being reported in May 1974 and throughout that entire year. Newsweek said, quote, since May 1974, more than 100 cattle have been found dead and gruesomely mutilated in Nebraska, Kansas, and Iowa. When a veterinarian examined the corpse of one mutilated cow, he found that all of the animal's blood had been drained, and at least one farmer claims that a shiny UFO landed in a field where a slaughtered animal was later found, unquote. And, of course, I have reported for years about the link between the discs, the non-humans, and the animal mutilation.
Sure have, Linda.
And those shiny, glowing discs, George, were being seen around the world in 1974, and some reports were even about disc retrievals with or without non-human entities that year. And one such event has received a very brief historic notation. The French website, ufology.net, states, quote, UFO crash in New Mexico, May 17, 1974, in Chillicothe. A U.S. Air Force team allegedly removed a 60-foot-wide metallic object from an impact area and moved it to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, unquote. Well, then I learned that only 1.5 weeks later, on May 28, 1974, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, known as NICAP, received reports from Albuquerque residents that on that morning, a large, very bright, glowing object was seen moving across the western side of the Sandia Mountains. An eyewitness opened his window to listen for noise, but there was none. And that glowing object landed on a nearby hill in the Sandias, where, quote, it remained for over an hour before it shot into the air and vanished, unquote. And then after that, a housewife in the same Sandia Hills region reported a 50 to 75 foot diameter object that, quote, displayed a distinct whirling motion as it rotated around its central axis, unquote. And that sighting lasted a minute. Well, that was the morning to midday on May 28, 1974. Research now suggests that by 9 p.m. on May 28th, more Albuquerque residents were watching a large glowing white disc moving from the south of Albuquerque and Kirtland Air Force Base to the northeast. The disc moved very slowly and steadily downward toward the lower Sandia Hills at the eastern edge of the city. And over at the Arroyo del Oso apartments at Pennsylvania and Montgomery, 8-year-old Paul McKeever was outside on the warm evening playing with his two cousins, Lisa, age 10, and Larry, age 4. The kids saw this large glowing football-shaped object in the sky, and they ran to the apartment yelling for their parents to come out, and the parents, Rebecca and Sandy, were already coming outside because they both heard a 770 KKOB radio announcement that an unidentified flying object was over Albuquerque. We went back to that apartment to begin our interview.
I just remember that they said an unidentified flying object has been seen over Albuquerque. And then we talked a couple of minutes about whether we should go see if we could find it or not. And that's when we got up and got to the door and the kids were coming in.
And we came out to get the kids to take them. And we could see the glow from it.
Like looking at a football sideways. It had a really intense glow, like a fluorescent bulb or like those globes. They have like a bulb inside of them that's white. And it had a real intense glow to it. And it was moving kind of towards us to the left is what I remember. We got in the car, and that's what I remember when we drove and were chasing it down, trying to see where it was going.
He and the other two children were outside playing, so they actually saw it before we did because we heard the announcement on the radio.
We more or less followed the glow. We went out Pennsylvania, and when we got to Manal, it looked like it was up at the end of Manal.
On April 1st, 2007, I traveled with Paul McKeever, his mom and aunt, out Pennsylvania and Manal beyond Tramway Boulevard, as far as we could go after 33 years of housing development spreading at the base of the Sandias in what were only dirt trails back in 1974. The family thought one particular rock-covered hill looked like the place they drove to following the glowing disc in the sky.
And we came up as far as we could on the pavement, and then it was like a, I guess you'd call it almost like a dirt trail that we took. It wasn't really a dirt road. It was like car tracks make through a field or something. We drove onto that, and we could see an object with a lot of light around it, bright light, and we were stopped. We were told we had to turn around and to leave the area.
Immediately.
Yeah. And he was very agitated.
And he was, he meant what he said.
Yeah, he was very, very serious. We were fairly close to the object, close enough to get a really good look at it and to see the people around it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Soldiers.
And,
yeah,
there were soldiers
the
around
military.
It. And they had it like a perimeter around it. And every so many feet, there was a soldier dotted around the thing.
They were armed.
They had M16s.
M16s.
And they were facing the object. And the thing was glowing intensely. The funny thing to me was that it was at the very bottom slope of the hill, but the thing was pretty level. But you couldn't really see anything underneath it. It was just kind of sitting level. But it looked like it was close enough to the ground to be on it, but it was level. That baffled me.
Because it was on a rocky surface.
Yeah.
It may have been hovering there.
That's what I would think now, thinking back, that that's exactly what it was. It was hovering.
Because there's no, I mean, you couldn't see any gear or legs or anything.
No, there was nothing,
see
anything to under it.
And it was glowing, so it was illuminating the area around it. Plus, they had the deuce and a half truck, which is a 2.5-ton truck that has a canvas back on it, but the canvas was off of it, and they had a spotlight mounted on the back. And they were searching the bushes and the area and the rocks outside and around of the object. It looked like they're trying to see if anything was like hiding in the bushes or around the rocks because they had soldiers around it, but the soldiers were back. They were, you know, away from the thing. They weren't like close to it. They were back away from it. To the right of the object, from our point of view, to the right, there was a whole pool of vehicles. And there was more personnel mixed in amongst the vehicles. From what I noticed, they're all military personnel. The only person that wasn't military was the guy who stopped us at the end of the road. From what I remember was that he had a state patrol uniform on. And I remember the car being a state police car because it was black and white. And the state trooper cars were black and white. The whole time this thing was glowing, he just made us turn around. We turned around and pretty much left the area. That was it. We just left.
There were other cars parked behind us that were coming up
the road, yeah.
The road also. And I'd say there was five or six at least behind us.
Yeah.
That I remember.
Military. They were here before us, which means that they had to be following the object the whole time because
there wasn't that much time.
There wasn't that much time, yeah, between when we saw it and went after it and it was on the ground. It couldn't have been more than 15 minutes, 20 minutes, something like that.
Seems like it. And it seems like I remember seeing other military vehicles driving into the area.
Yeah, that's what
they
I was
weren't,
thinking,
everybody,
too.
I mean, there were a lot of people there, but
already,
there were some
there were
more coming in.
Coming in.
And it was all the military.
From that hill, we're real close to how far we were that night.
Yeah.
For this kind of thing, we were very close.
Very close, yeah.
Yeah, we got a lot closer than you would think you could get to something like that. Nowadays, I don't know if...
We could have gotten in that close before we were stopped.
We were very close.
Yeah, because they only had one guy turning traffic around, the state trooper.
And,
And you're looking at a disc.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 40 feet in diameter.
Yeah, approximately 40 feet. Judging by what I remember how big the soldiers looked to the thing, I remember it being about 40 feet in diameter, maybe 10, 12 feet, somewhere in there tall.
So for that disc to be looking totally flat and horizontal to you, how would you explain that if there is a slanted hill?
I don't know. That's the question. You know, I don't know what...
It was either hovering or...
glowing, so it must have been under some kind of power to hold it there, you know, in a level position, because you couldn't see anything
under it.
Protruded out to
help it, you know, sit there, whatever.
Because it was lighting up the whole area, so you could see ground underneath it and around it, and then plus the spotlight was shining around, and so it was very strange to me that it was level on the side of a hill.
Very strange.
What a story.
Yeah, and there's more to come. Paul and his mom and aunt have more to say in the next half hour, but I wanted to try to give a context here for what might have been happening in Albuquerque on May 28th all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, a decade before the Sandia Hills event, back on April 25th, 1964, there was supposed to have been a prearranged meeting between extraterrestrial biological entities known as Ebens, an American military at Holloman Air Force Base near White Sands Missile Range south of Albuquerque. During that alleged alien and human meeting, three football or egg-shaped white craft, just like what Paul McKeever and his mom and aunt are describing, hovered in a defensive triangular pattern close to the ground. I have been told that the non-humans gave military representatives some advanced technologies and agreed to take three of our military to their planet in an exchange program, while two or three of the Ebens remained on Earth as, quote, visitors, unquote, at Los Alamos Laboratory and other sites. Now, this exchange program is perhaps what President Ronald Reagan was referring to when he told Close Encounters film director Steven Spielberg that the scene with people going aboard the big mothership was, quote, close to historic reality, unquote. Now, it's possible that in May 1974, that the brightly glowing disc that seemed to hover horizontally on that rocky Sandia hillside was, for the whole day, from morning to night, was hanging around the Sandia Hills, and it may have been that it was some sort of communication going on with some agency or unit at Kirtland Air Force Base, and that is why so much military got to the site so rapidly before Paul's family and the other cars. And I am hoping tonight that someone listening was also there in May 1974 on that Sandia dirt trail watching the glowing disc surrounded by military, or was one of the military people. And if so, please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. As Paul McKeever and his family said to me, quote, we all deserve to know the truth about the discs. And if enough witnesses speak up, maybe they can make a difference, even if it's 33 years later. And coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear more from the family and what other disc activity was going on around Albuquerque, New Mexico, and those mountains.
And Linda, right after the break, what we'll do is we'll have you wrap up with the second part of this story, and then we'll have time to take a few phone calls. You want to do that this hour?
Yes, I was going to give some more historic data, but I would be happy to do that.
We'll have time for all that. So stick with us. Linda Moulton Howe, earthfiles.com. That's her website. And if you need to email me, well, that's just George at coasttocoastam.com. So we'll be right back. We'll get part two of Linda's investigation of still another bizarre, incredible story. And then a little bit later on this half hour, we'll just have 10 minutes or so for your phone calls with her on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Quayle joins us next hour as we talk about weather manipulation. But let's go back to Linda Moulton Howe now and get her to wrap up this part of the story before we take phone calls with her. Go ahead, Linda.
Okay, the scene is that Paul, his mom, and aunt, and I are up on the Sandia Hills, standing as close as they thought that they were to where this glowing disc and the military were back in 1974. And we are talking about what in the world could have been going on that this disc is hovering there horizontally on a hill that has a definitely slanted slope and a lot of rocks on it, and it could not have landed, and it definitely was not a crash. And we pick up now with Paul, who is not certain that it was a prearranged meeting, but that none of them have an answer.
The way the soldiers were around it with the spotlight and everything, it wasn't something that I think that they were expecting, you know. But to me, it looked like maybe it was disabled or was caused to be disabled. I don't know.
They had a reason, the military, for being there so quickly.
Yeah. It was a group put together in case something like that happened. Because it was just like, how do you get stuff, all that equipment, all those people ready so quick?
And it was like they were standing there guarding it, like they were waiting for someone or something to come out of it.
Yeah.
Or to someone to come and tell them what to do.
Well, you could definitely tell that they were cautious of it. You know, when I was in the Army, when you guarded something, you faced away from it. So they weren't guarding it like it was ours. They were around it like they were keeping it contained almost, you know. Because if it was ours, the guards would have been facing away from it.
How do you think that they kept this totally bottled up all these years?
You know, I'm sure the government, if they wanted to keep it quiet, they probably went to the TV, radio, and newspaper and told them to keep it quiet, because there was nothing on the news, there was nothing in the newspaper or on the radio the next day or even several days after. It was just like it never happened.
Like it never happened.
As to why the people, though, that were there, like us, and the people that were in their cars, I don't know why no one ever said anything. We didn't. I don't know.
I don't know if they were contacted and told not to, or if they just thought people thought they were crazy, or...
But we were definitely intimidated, because we immediately... We didn't ask what's going on after he told us to leave. We immediately turned the car around and went straight home.
And when he told us to turn around and the way he was acting, I remember it scared me when I was a kid.
And he said it in a very authoritative voice.
Yeah.
Like there was no point in asking any questions because we weren't going to get any answers.
Yeah, because he was very, very stern about it and irritated and nervous.
Did he aim a gun at you?
No.
No,
he didn't.
No, no gun.
No.
And what made you decide in 2007 to contact me?
I was just curious. I wanted to know if other people were on the web reporting the same event that we saw. So I started contacting and asking questions to see if I could get other people that had witnessed the event.
And Sandy and Rebecca, you were young adults then. Have you ever talked about this with other people to find out if they saw it?
No.
Just strangely
with the
enough,
family,
we haven't.
Just family, no. But I've never told anyone except family.
Do you have any idea why?
No, I don't.
No, I've thought about it, and I don't know. Don't know why.
Yeah,
I never mentioned it.
And we didn't talk that much about it, even with family.
Do you think that it was that you were literally so scared?
We did tell family, but mm-hmm.
Well, it's hard to talk about something like that without...
Yeah.
You don't want people
to
think that you're crazy or that you're weird or something. But over the years, it's gotten to the point to where I just didn't really care.
Well, that's good. Go ahead, Linda, wrap this up.
Well, now Paul, his mom, and I searched the Albuquerque Journal microfilm, And we searched for an entire 12-month period from May 1973 to May 1974 to look for any events that would be like this. And believe it or not, on page C20 in the Daily Record, on what date? May 29th, 1974, the next day, there was a blockout card in the lower half of page C20. But I went to get this photographed, wondering what in the world. And then, as I kept going through the microfilm, I realized that right after the blockout on the bottom half of C20, the very next three pages in the microfilm were identical copies of page C20 without the blocking card. So I went to the librarian and I asked why there was a blocking card on one page followed by three perfectly readable pages. He had no explanation and he seemed puzzled himself and raised a question in my mind. Is it possible that an agent of the American government under orders went to the Albuquerque Journal publisher and said, in the interest of national security, we need you to change page C20 of your May 29th, 1974 issue that might have had some blurb about this, what was going on in the Sandia Hills? I know that in my own research of contacting libraries all over the state of New Mexico looking for specific newspapers and specific dates in the 1940s, that I've had librarians tell me that the entire state seems to have had selective removal of certain dates that none of the libraries have. And it's this idea of being able to sanitize events like this and keep it covered up, both through intimidation and by some kind of erasure, that this is a very, very important story. And there is a whole lot more that was happening around that time. But what, since we're going to try to take some phone calls yet tonight, what I'd like to say is that hopefully some Coast listeners tonight here in Albuquerque or were here in Albuquerque back in May 1974, and they might know more about this disc encounter with the military in Sandia Hills. And if so, I hope you would be willing to email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com or to call in tonight and next week on Friday, December 7th. I'll have a follow-up to this government secrecy and yet another alleged government secret, a clandestine American astronaut corps and space program. And then we're going to have the whole second hour for phone calls, and I hope I can learn more from Coast feedback. So, George, this is a very, very important story.
Sure
with very solid people, and I'm grateful we've been able to get this much out, and maybe somebody listening will have some information tonight.
And maybe more. Stay with us. We'll take your phone calls next with Linda Moulton Howe. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe. And you know, Linda, it's one thing to have people, eyewitnesses, see a glowing disc. It's another thing to see military people surround it.
Right, and that they had a light all, and that they had jeeps, and the military was there, and they were driving from Montgomery and Pennsylvania Montgomery. It's only about 20 minutes from that corner up to the Sandia Hills, and that means that the military was already assembling there when that was in the air.
Let's take some calls. First-time caller line, you're up with Linda. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jim from Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
You know it well. My son went to school there, and you had years ago one incredible apparent UFO crash out that way, Jim.
1941.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I learned about that when I first moved up here. It was really interesting. I've talked to a few people that remember that time, and it was really strange. There was a preacher here in town. It was one of the first called out there. They thought it was a plane crash, and they wanted him to go give the last rites to dying people. And I talked to his daughter, who still lives here, and it was really amazing the things that she remembered from back then.
You've got to get her phone number and get it to us, Linda. Here's another person you'd probably love to interview.
Absolutely, I would love to talk with her if you can get the phone number to George or email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I would love to talk with her.
Yes, ma'am. I'll see if I can do that, if I can remember, because this has been about 6 years ago. But I believe she's still here in town.
Okay.
And I will do that. And Mr. Norrie, I'll get that to you. And Ms. Howe, I do have your website, so I can email that to you.
Great.
My question is, in the late 80s, I heard about an exchange program.
Right.
That was going on. And you had referenced that I hate to say aliens, were being held captive.
Well, they called them extraterrestrial biological entities, and
yes,
others
ma'am.
Called them aliens, so...
Project Serpo, though, Linda, right?
Yeah. Well, the Serpo may be some intel test.
True.
But
true.
What I heard back in the early 80s were three people went from Holloman Air Force Base in an exchange program that began April 25th, 1964 at Holloman. And I know others who have that same date and have that same information. It's quite different from Serpo. That isn't to say that there might have been another exchange that is what the Serpo material is about. There may have been many or several. And that's where we need honesty. We need truth from this government about exactly what the DIS technology is, who is in all of these aerial craft. What does our government know, and why do they think that we all should be kept in the dark? And that's why I'm appealing to anybody listening who may have information about Albuquerque, May 1974, or any other encounter between military and DISCs. That is especially important because all of my research indicates that our government has had some kind of, I'm going to say, communication both in conflict and meetings with non-humans for a very long time, whether they admit it or not.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Jim. And see if you can get that information to us. East of the Rockies, you're on with us. Hi there.
George?
Yes, the truth.
Hi. My name is Tony.
Hey, Tony, and where might you be?
I am just outside of Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay, Tony. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
This I've not really, you know, I've told people in passing and friends and so forth, but back in October of 1973, we lived in Milford, Ohio, which is just outside of Cincinnati. I was 8 years old at the time. My sister is 5 years younger than me, so she doesn't really remember. But my father, my mother, we were in the car. We were coming home late on a Sunday night. From my grandmother's, who lived just west of that, we saw coming down Old Indian Hill Road a huge bright light up in the sky. And about 12 blocks further, we get to an intersection, and this large, very large cigar-shaped object was about 200 feet above the treetops and flew right over the intersection. Now, the thing is, it was moving very slow. There were three or four other cars at the intersection. And then we lived in Milford. When we got home, our next-door neighbors was actually a police officer for Milford.
Mm-hmm.
His wife came running up to the car and was hysterical. Did you see it? Did you see it?
Another witness.
Yes. It had flown at the end of our street, and they witnessed it also before it got to the intersection and so forth. Now, the thing is, evidently that same night, police officers in Owensville, Ohio, which is further east of Milford, also got reports and witnessed it over the school. And in another county, in West Union, Ohio, just Adams County, a couple of counties over from Claremont there, police officers also witnessed it going over an intersection there. And somebody actually, I found it on a website that somebody put together about this rash of UFO sightings in 1973 in the Cincinnati area. So those are actually like Cincinnati Inquirer paper reports and all of this.
Linda, have you heard of anything like this?
Yeah, 73 was an active year, not as active as 74, which just took a huge spike around the world. But what I'm interested in, was there any big story and play on radio, television, and your newspapers in that area after all of these people saw this low-flying aerial craft?
Any media there, Tony, afterwards?
About a year or so ago, I thought I would try to find something on what happened that night, if there was any reports. And like I said, somebody actually gathered a bunch of these reports from, like, the Cincinnati Inquirer newspapers and so forth. I was 8 years old at the time. So there evidently was media reports and everything, because this was evidently there were a number of reports over a period of about a week within this area.
So it could have been a little flap there, Linda.
Well, yes, it was going on. There was no question. 73, 74, 75, 76, they were all really intense years. But 74 in Albuquerque, what impresses me is that this occurred and somehow the media and the public, there was a complete erasure of the event. And here are people who admit that they sat on this story up close and personal for 33 years. And they never told anybody until they talked to me this year.
Okay, thanks, Tony. We have time for maybe one or two more calls. West of the Rockies, you're on with Linda. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
This is Dennis from the Seattle-Tacoma area.
Yeah, sure thing.
You just mentioned flap, and so I was wondering if Linda knows why there are flaps. I remember the Lorenzans of April several years ago believed it had to do with the close approach of Mars.
That's a good question. Well, why the waves?
Well, Linda? It is a good question. I guess now, after all of the education that I've had so far, even though I can't prove, I do feel that there have been waves of retaliation and attack going on between our government and this phenomenon. And that when there is a flare-up of some of the activity, I think it's because there are standoffs and conflicts, and there is a huge body now of emerging evidence that our government, for a period of time, was trying to attack this disk technology, and apparently payback was quite painful. And then we stopped trying to aggressively attack them the way we were trying with missiles and artillery. And today, in my mind, is the question, what are we doing in 2007? And that relates to next Friday's Coast, in which I will be on for 2 hours with a fascinating new set of research data about the fact that there may have been a secret military space program since at least the end of the 1950s in parallel with the public civilian NASA, and that it may have been provoked largely because of the interaction of non-human intelligences on this planet that our government is still trying to keep under lock and key.
You know, Linda, Richard C. Hoagland has been saying for years, too, that there's a secret military program out there. And for a long time, it fell on deaf ears. You know what? I think he's right.
Oh, it goes back. I'm going to share, Nick, on Friday, an amazing story from the New York Times. Richard Souter, a very good researcher, investigator,
sure,
and author, found this New York Times article from August 7th, 1989, about the secret astronaut corps in the military.
God.
And I will share more about that, plus a whole lot of surprises about the background of Neil Armstrong and a whole huge, gigantic link to another Middle Eastern space program. And all of this comes back to what was going on in Albuquerque in 1974. Well, out in Coyote Canyon, which is what I was going to talk about, but I'm glad we've had the phone calls, we were storing, and probably are to this day, storing nukes inside of the Manzano Mountains at Coyote Canyon.
Jeez.
Where
right.
UFOs were landing.
Next week, Linda, we'll talk to you next Friday. Linda Moulton Howe with a 2-hour special on December 7th. And I'll forget that day. That's Pearl Harbor Day. We'll be back.